If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Picture the scene. I'm 18 years old. Half my life away now. And I went up to Cambridge and went to see my director of studies, John Parry, who said, right, you've chosen medieval, which was a box I'd ticked at the beginning of the preceding summer holidays and hadn't given it too much extra thought. off you go to Sydney Sussex College and meet your supervisor's called Helen Castor. And so I did. And, I mean, she was brilliant. You know, you couldn't imagine how transformative Helen's teaching was.
That was Dan Jones describing his history education.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. As regular listeners will be aware, all of this week we've been running special editions of the podcast to celebrate our 500th episode, where we're interviewing some of our favourite guests who've appeared since we began in 2007. In today's episode, you'll be hearing from the historian, author and broadcaster Dan Jones. Back in October 2015, Dan was interviewed for our podcast by fellow historian Helen Castor about his book on the year 1215. And that remains our most popular podcast ever, with more than 210,000 downloads so far. So it seemed fitting to welcome Dan back on the show for our 500th episode week, to explain the secrets of being a successful historian, and to discuss some of his most interesting projects to date. Our website assistant, Rachel Dinning, paid a visit to Dan in his home just outside of London, and here's how that interview went.
So, Dan, I think it's fair to say that you're a historian who's very good at making medieval history popular. You've had multiple best-selling books, and one of your previous podcasts with us, which explored medieval life in the year 1215, is officially our most downloaded podcast to date. So what do you think it is? What's the secret to your success? How do you make medieval history interesting?
God, you started me off with an easy one. First of all of that is, of course, extremely flattering. And I didn't know that statistic about the being the most popular. I don't know if you call it imposter syndrome. I think you probably do. But I just sort of slightly don't believe it, in the sense that whenever I go and give a talk, you know, like the BBC History Weekends in Winchester and York or whatever, I'm always amazed to see a crowd. And I always feel a sort of sense of, they must have thought it was Dan Snow. I mean, plainly, that, you know, this can't actually be here for this. And so to that extent, whenever I bump up against the question of trying to analyse why people want to listen to me, I'm sort of immediately just bump up against what is probably the kind of confines of my own self-doubt. What I can talk to is what I try to do with the books that I write, and TV shows to a certain extent as well, which is to say that I've tried to fuse two things. One is scholarly research, and the other is a sort of a concentrated and a highly focused approach to storytelling, which draws on the mechanics to an extent of fiction, but not really of fiction, much more the mechanics of television writing, screenwriting. And I would say that, you know, the longer I go on, the more it's about, always about those two things, you know, getting the research as up to date and as good and as solid and as reliable and as footnoted and as da 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 as everything as it possibly can be. And spending an immense amount of time on story architecture, story structure, the things that are familiar to anyone who watches Netflix series or big blockbuster movies, because I think that those tropes and shapes of storytelling are what we are exposed to so much and are so sophisticated in those genres that to bring them into history is the obvious thing to do, because we're in general telling human stories. And if people respond to that, and, you know, from what you've said, I accept that they do, and I'm very glad that they do, and always sort of proud and even humbled when I experience it. I hope that that's what they're responding to.
What's your process then when writing a book? When you say have an idea, what do you sit down and do first?
I basically start by reading an awful lot, you know, around whatever subject it is, primary sources, secondary sources, you know, immerse yourself in the material. But in a sense, that's obvious. Of course I do. That's what writing history is about. Now, what I used to do, I don't do this so much, is I used to work on what I call the grid, which is analogous, if anyone's really studied the sort of British politics in the 1990s, to the Alistair Campbell press grid. That wasn't a deliberate choice, I hasten to add. But it would be so build it in Excel spreadsheet, and it would be a sort of a box-by-box plan of the book, you know, chapter by chapter, what characters were going to go in there, what key, you know, incidents, what primary, secondary sources I needed, what, you know, how themes fitted together. And I could see it. I'd build the book in this thing. I'd be able to see it. I'd be able to move things around. I'd be able to actually see what I call the skeleton, the bones of the story. I now don't really do that. I don't do it on Excel. I've covered one of the walls in my office in corkboard. And so now I do it on bits of paper that I can physically move around, a bit like a sort of analog version of Minority Report or whatever is in that movie.
Yeah.
So I physically, but it's still the same thing. It's bits of paper with my kind of ideas moved around. And then I spend a couple of months doing that sometimes, pacing around my office, listening to sort of deep house music and just sort of thinking my way into and moving elements of the story around. And then I get to a stage where I've kind of fixed the shape of it in mind, then I start to write. And by that stage, the writing then comes pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a case of marshalling material, but the physical mechanics of writing don't take particularly long. But it's that story build stage that's the critical part of the work.
What's the most challenging part for you? Is it finding the, you know, the historical facts, or is it the actual piecing it together in a way that's fresh and interesting and having this interesting narrative?
You have to be in the right mood to do either one of them. So there can be days where I just fall asleep at my desk every day because I'm just trawling sources. And there can be days where I stand in frustration in front of the cork board because I can't marshal my ideas correctly. But I'm old and I've been around the block enough to not get too stressed out about that anymore. And fundamentally, I really, really, really love what I do. And so difficult isn't really the right word. There are different sort of forms of challenge.
So I mentioned this podcast, our podcast with you that is the most popular, it's the most downloaded one ever. So it was the one you did with Helen Castor. I don't know if you can cast your mind back.
Was that a Castor pun?
Oh, that was completely unintentional. So you were exploring medieval life in the year 1215.
Yeah.
I believe Helen Castor actually taught you at university, is that correct?
Yeah, you believe absolutely correctly. So... picture the scene, I'm 18 years old, so half my life I've got away now. And I went up to Cambridge and went to see my director of studies, John Parry, who said, right, you've chosen medieval, which was a box I'd ticked at the beginning of the preceding summer holidays and hadn't given it too much extra thought. off you go to Sydney Sussex College and meet your supervisors called Helen Castor. And so I did. And, I mean, it was... She was brilliant. You know, you couldn't imagine how transformative Helen's teaching was. You know, she was and still is. But at that stage, she was, to me, shockingly brilliant in a way that I just hadn't encountered. You know, I'd never been in a room to be taught by a Cambridge Don or Oxbridge Don before in my life. I'd no idea what to expect. And here was one who wasn't only... fiercely and pointedly and laser-guidedly bright, but was also kind of a sort of cool, young, hip person who spoke the same sort of language and had the same cultural touch points that I did, and we got on really well. And still do get on really well. And I just sort of learned pretty much everything I knew, firstly from, in medieval terms anyway, firstly from her and then from Christine Carpenter, who'd taught her, and as well as many other brilliant medievalists working today. And that was really, you know, it was her that got me hooked on the Middle Ages. First essay she sent me, I can still vividly remember, it was about King John. I think we probably talked about that in the podcast
you
referred to. The first, you know, the title of the essay, I believe, I'll probably get it wrong now, was what was the issue between John and the barons? It seems such a simple question, you know, but actually in answering that question, you know, you're thrown... like head first into the central constitutional question in England in the Middle Ages, from which you never escape, no matter which king of the Plantagenet era you study.
How strange is it now, thinking 18-year-old... What would 18-year-old you think of the idea of you being interviewed by Helen all these years later, and she's grilling you as you've just published this book and you're now an expert on that era?
Well, in the sense of your peers.
Yeah.
Well, 18-year-old me, I was very sort of willful and hard-headed and sort of insouciant, but also quite a stubborn person at the age of 18, and to a degree probably still am, but I've just had my eyes forcibly opened by age. I just don't think 18-year-old me, like 18-year-old most people, really would have I didn't care very much. I'd been surprised if you'd have told me that I would still be talking about King John. I think the idea that this was more than this was not just sort of weekly essay, which I was kind of passing through, and that actually, you know, as I say, that's literally half my life. I'm still basically talking about the same thing. I think I've been quite surprised to have known that, but not unhappy. Or rather, if I look at it from this angle. Certainly not unhappy, you know. It's been a wonderful sort of 18 years since that day.
Why did you choose history at university? Did you want to go on to... You can't predict the future, and most teenagers don't know what they want to do, but What was your thinking?
It was my best subject at school, as they say.
Classic answer.
You don't have a massive range of seen very much of life. You know, when I was 18 years old, I'd been to school. I didn't really know much else about the world. And I'd done my A-levels that I did were history, economics, maths, and English. And I didn't want to be an economist. I was fairly sure of that. I'd seen enough graphs to know that it was something I'd find dull. You know, mathematics was something I'd chosen to study because I wasn't very good at it. And I wanted to sort of, you know, pull myself up to a sort of base competence. English... I spoke English. I would have gone and studied English probably had I not studied history. But I'm glad I didn't because I wouldn't have been very good at it. But history, I just had a really great teacher called Mr. Green. See, I still want to call him Mr. Green. His name's Robin Green. We're both adults now. He was a fantastic, fantastic teacher and just really, really liked. It's taken me under his wing a little bit, but don't get into your head that this was the history boys. He was just a very good, enthusiastic, motivating teacher and encouraged me to go on and read his subject. And I was very glad to do so. But there was no plan beyond that. I was going to go to university and read history and then see what happened at the end of it. Now, what happened to most people who went down the sort of path within the Cambridge Tripos that I did, which is, you know, pretty much choose your own adventure, I ended up studying medieval English legal history. There were six of us in when I was in my third year doing it. And the idea in most cases was that you went on from that to the bar because it was a good training in English constitutional history. So you would go into a law conversion course, bar vocational course, pupillage at whatever chambers you're in, and then you'd be a sort of bloke in a wig doing whatever you did, you know, whatever aspect of law. You know, I actually still thought probably when I graduated that would ultimately be where I got to, but then I just didn't do it. I had a girlfriend at the time who instead got, you know, fed up with me moping around, not knowing what I wanted to do, and on my behalf applied to journalism school for me. So, from one scurrilous profession to the other, instead of going into law school, I went to journalism school. I didn't last very long there.
Was that a bit of a shock going from writing history essays to the world of journalism, where I'm sure they were getting you to go out and find stories?
I hated it. I mean, it's funny saying that because, you know, I still write a lot of what you would call journalism. But journalism school that I went to I did one term there. And then I left, as they say in football, by mutual consent. But in the newspaper journalism course that I took was to be a reporter, you know, actual serious journalism,
sniffing
not the sort
out
of
stories.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a writer. I'm not a reporter. And it was like get a story every day, death knock journalism, I call it. You know, the sort of got to be the kind of hound that's glad to. Mm-hmm. You know,
walk there's a car somewhere. Accident, you go knock on the door of
knock,
the person
knock. Who's
who's
there?
Died.
Your son's dead, give us a quote.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds harsh, but that was the sort of thing. And I recognised immediately that I was absolutely not cut out for that. And I'm glad that I did as well, because I've been miserable pursuing it. And my classmates were brilliant. Were absolutely brilliant because their girlfriends hadn't applied for them to go on this course. They'd done it themselves. It was something they desperately knew they wanted to do. And many of them are high-flying, excellent journalists now. And I'm really glad that I sort of, didn't actually see that through. But weirdly, I am glad. I mean, I carried on writing journalism, but just not of the hard variety.
Yeah, the hard news. It's kind of interesting though, because it's all about storytelling, and what you do now is storytelling, and journalism's just a slightly different form of storytelling. I was going to ask, so there's a bit of a debate going on at the moment about higher education. I mean, obviously fees have risen in recent years. People talk, what is the value of going to university? I mean, do you think that studying a subject like history at university or English, you know, one of these humanities, is there a value to it?
I find the framework of this debate infuriating, because value has been taken to mean what in business is called return on investment, which is understandable given that you now have to borrow a lot of money to go to university, such that we now are encouraged, I think deliberately, to think of higher education as a purely transactional thing. You know, you're going to pay to make it okay, to try and justify charging people these amount of fees. Well, you know, if you spend this money we're going to allow you to borrow on the right subject, don't worry, because you'll get a lot of money back. But I tell you what, don't bother doing those kind of wishy-washy subjects like the humanities, for God's sake, because we don't know where you're going to end up. So that you come out with this weird idea, which is, not expressed by everyone, but often by particularly stupid government ministers, who say things like, oh, we don't want people taking medieval history, so it'll waste. Right, value in terms of higher education is not return on investment. It is addition to your roundedness and fulfillment as a human being. And there is a reason why the humanities have persisted at the centre of higher education for literally centuries, and have been a sort of higher form of knowledge for literally millennia. And that's because they have value. And whether we can, you know, account for that in terms of, will you effectively make your money back on the loan we're now making you take out instead of, you know, the state providing higher education for you, is neither here nor there. And it's sort of scoundrel argument to suggest otherwise, because if you look along like the front benches in Parliament, you're going to find a lot of people who did PPE, SPS, history. I would venture even a couple who did English. If you were to look around the sort of well-to-do of the British acting elite, people like Tom Hiddleston and Eddie Redmayne, who I went to university with, I think Eddie was there at the same time I was. If you look around the banking sector, if you look around almost every sort of successful industry, you're going to find people who went and studied humanities. It gets written off as a sort of a kind of frivolous waste of your time at university, and that just couldn't be anything further from the truth. We're turning out people who understand the sort of history and the condition of human society and have devoted a long time to thinking about it, studying it and analysing it. And if you can't put value on that, then we're living in a sort of a Philistine society. I don't believe we are living in a Philistine society. I believe we're living in a society that is creating fake arguments to justify massive changes with regard to the structure of state spending.
What would your advice be then to someone who is perhaps, 18 and they look at you, or they look at Helen Castor or Susanna Lipscomb or any of these historians who are sort of in the public eye, and they think, oh, I'd like to do what they do, or I'd like to write a history book. What would your advice be?
Well, first you've got to study history. So put aside these mealy-mouthed arguments that it's a waste of your time. I think, you mentioned me and Susie and Helen there. I think we've all had pretty different paths. I mean, I've certainly not taken the same path as either of those two, and we've ended up in broadly the same place. I think a lot of it is about, firstly, there's your development as a historian, and there's no skirting around that. So I can understand the appeal of a sort of imagined career path where you go from doing a history degree to presenting civilizations. But you do have to be a sort of, in some senses, credible historian, whether that's within academia, whether that's outside academia, or whether it's with a foot in both camps, which a lot of people, that's where they reside, I mean, our peers. And also accept that in doing that, there are a lot of people who want to parlay a sort of career in history into a career in TV. Mm. I don't think a career in TV is something to aim at in the sense that it's going to be a career, like in the old fashioned sense, lasting 40 years. Because if you think about how many people have been on television for 40 years, you know, you're down to like Bruce Forsyth, who's, you know, and a few football commentators, and Anton Deck, and they're not 40 years. Yeah, you know, most TV careers are very short, five years or fewer.
Or you do a bit and then...
Or you do a bit, you disappear, and then they get you out for the canal boat. See, I skipped the middle bit of that. So I think it's important to say, okay, if I really want a career in history, then, you know, you've got to do the sensible bit, which is like get a job, find some way to make money, and then start scrabbling around with everybody else for sort of the limited number of TV gigs that there are.
Were you ever tempted to go into academia?
Yeah, actually, I skipped a bit of the story earlier, which was that before I went to journalism college, I wanted to do at least the first year of PhD, but then I didn't have any money and couldn't afford to do it. But, you know, when I left Cambridge in 2002, both Christine Carpenter, professor of English medieval history, and David Starkey, who'd been my supervisor and who I trusted and listened to, both told me better not to go into academia for different reasons. Christine very perceptively said, you're not cut out for it. And David said, there's not enough money in it. And I told you something about both of them. I think David said, if you're going to do it, for God's sake, go to the States. It'll pay you properly.
Interesting.
But they were both right. You know, I wouldn't have been a very good academic.
Do you think you have to have a certain kind of personality to go into, like, what you've done, which is, you know, TV presenting and stuff? You have to have that.
TV presenting...
What about you?
TV presenting is a very odd and unusual thing, an unnatural thing, let's say, to do. And bear in mind that for the majority of my life and the majority of my career, I've not been a TV presenter. That actually is literally about 5 years, which by my earlier mathematics indicates is very soon coming to an end. Let's hope not. It's a certain type of skill. And I was quite lucky when I started working with Channel 5 that they gave me 6 weeks of sort of presenter training, which most people don't get. They're just sent out one day with a TV crew and expected to know how to do it. And there are certain technical skills that you have to be able to deploy, otherwise it's very frustrating for your crew working with you. One of them's remembering your lines. Another one is being able to analyse a script and a piece of camera and identify whether or not it's going to work and be able to involve yourself in the production process, which I do probably to the irritation of my producers. What most people do, and I'm sure I did as well, maybe I still do, what most people do when they're first asked to present on television or on camera of any sort is immediately start, whether consciously or unconsciously, acting the role of a presenter. And they do present a sort of a whole range of unnatural mannerisms that they've seen other presenters, usually like BBC News reporters, do.
That's interesting, because a news reporter is a completely different...
Right, it is. But it's sort of different sentence construction, different intonations, different physical movements. And all of that is actually very hard to not do. Because if you just sort of, you know, slouch about, slob about, like... People will say, you've got to be yourself. Just be yourself on TV. If you're just yourself on TV, then it is... That doesn't work either. Mm-hmm. So you need to create a sort of slightly larger-than-life version of yourself that's not a caricature of the generic TV presenter. And that's actually quite hard for most people to do. And it takes a lot of practice and experience. It has taken me a lot of practice and experience anyway to find a place where you're sort of relaxed and... relaxed enough to sort of affect an easy familiarity with the viewer through the TV camera.
How nerve-wracking was it for you doing your first history TV gig then? Was it nerve-wracking?
Not nerve-wracking, but bewildering, mm-hmm. I think. I think nerve-wracking for me was like was speaking on stage for the first few years. I just get very nervous about that. That
you've got like an instant feedback because you can see everyone sort of looking back at you.
Yeah.
Whereas TV actually is that camera, and it's almost, you're a bit detached from the audience.
You're completely detached. And there's also, if you're making documentary, it's different if you're doing live TV. But there's also the sense that you're just going to do it as many times as it takes until you sort of get it right. But it's quite bewildering because, you know, you go into television, the sort of arena of making television, and no one in general explains to you, hey, this is what we're going to do, and this is what all this sort of terminology means. This is the difference between sync and non-sync and big wide and 200. And, you know, the sort of the terminology of the camera that everyone working TV is so used to talking about that they just assume that it's part of everybody's vocabulary. And, you know, and you're usually shooting things out of sequence and you're doing everything a million times and you very seldom get feedback about why. And so you're thinking, oh, my God, did I do that wrong or no? Well, they were just doing it different shot sizes. And so there's an awful lot technically to learn. Which, as I said, you know, I was fortunate that I'd been given a degree, actually a fairly healthy degree of training for at five. But there's still a lot to pick up. And so it's just a huge amount of information to absorb. And then the sense that everyone's looking at you. It was weird. But also enormous fun. I mean, come on, you know, it's just sort of walking around and talking. And talking about something that ideally one feels passionate about and has strong opinions on. And so I enjoyed starting out a lot, and I enjoyed it in a different way today. Starting out, it was like a massive adrenaline all the time, exhausted, and I lose a lot of weight over the course of shooting. Most people put on weight when they shoot.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because you usually try to stay in Premier Inns and eating in Hungry Horses and eating fish and chips basically three times a day. I used to lose, like, shed weight while we were filming. Just, I'd be, like, stressed. Like, not stressed, but, like, huge adrenaline.
Living on
going
adrenaline.
All the time. And now I just put on loads of weight when we're filming. Just eating Hungry Horse three times a day. Like, you know, I'm not, like, stressed out about it. But I should make it plain, I'm not at all complaining. I'm just sort of observing the oddities of this strange, you know, people are still captivated by television, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
You know, even in this age of new media and the extraordinary ease to market of broadcasting, you know, you just pick up your phone, film something and stick it on YouTube. TV's essential sort of cut off, you know, high wall, you know, difficult barrier to entry still makes it this magic, this allure that people are fascinated by and desperate to know what happens behind the curtain and off the camera. And it's extraordinary that medium's retained its allure even in these times.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
So one of the TV series that you've recently been involved with is Nightfall. So this is a historical drama. It recently aired in the US and it's coming to the UK this week. So by the time this podcast goes out, it will be on TV. It covers the downfall of the Knights Templar, which was a real event in history. But it also includes, you know, mythologies about the Grail and these fictional characters from Arthurian legend. So another, this is another big debate. What's your take on the balance between historical accuracy in historical drama and then, you know, drama?
What's my take? My take is that it is always a blend, and that, you know, at one end of that the scale you have something, let's say, like Wolf Hall, which is usually these days held up as a sort of epitome of being as historically accurate as possible. But note those words, as possible. They implicitly recognise that it is impossible, that it is, you know, it's not going to happen, that you're not going to be fully historically accurate. And guess why? Because you're making a drama. At the other end of the scale, there are projects which, you know, I don't think there's any profit in naming, in which history, you know, informs, let's say, the costume department to an extent and set design, and it's a sort of broad locator for a dramatic piece, and really it's not that important. You know, you can make great historical pieces at either end of the scale. I mean, let's take Blackadder. Blackadder II. Not many elements of Blackadder II were authentic to the real court of Queen Elizabeth, but it was a fantastic historical piece, making these kind of layered jokes about history as we consume, regurgitate and perceive it. And it was brilliantly written, comedic piece in historical costume. I mean, I don't think anyone would claim it was historically quote-unquote accurate, but it was fantastic, classic British television, still stands up today.
Gets people interested in history.
Gets people interested in history. So my first observation is that there's not a line of wrongness to rightness that exactly tracks with accuracy to, with non-accuracy to accuracy. I do think it helps enormously if the writers of historical drama or comedy or whatever it is are interested in and immersed in the historical source material. Because when that doesn't happen, usually that's when they write themselves into mistakes that could easily have been avoided.
The other thing I was thinking was, do the audience actually want historical accuracy? They may say that they do, but I always wonder, like, do they actually want how women were treated back then? Do you know what I mean? Like, do they actually want the accuracy, because it might not be as palatable as...
I think you're hitting on a very important and interesting point about history, you know, and drama, which is to say that, generally speaking, if something is brilliantly written, you'll find that the audience will go with you. You make any historical piece, you know, from the get-go, you have to accept that there will be a small quotient of people who are going to point out the things that you get wrong anyway, because it's a sort of hobby for certain people that's a bit like picking their scabs. And that's just how it is. But usually I think you only get into some mainstream kind of, hey, you got it wrong history beatings if actually there's a deeper problem with the programme and that it's not very well written.
So you think people overlook things a little bit if you know, it's a great story with great characterisation?
You can buy yourself an awful lot of sympathy and understanding on behalf of the audience if you have a compelling piece of television that tends to evaporate. The goodwill of the audience evaporates quite quickly if you just have a very badly written piece. And then they just go looking for things that are wrong with it. And it's always easy to find historical errors. It's much easier to find the errors than to start listing the things that the you know, the hardworking and intelligent people who make these programs have striven to get right, which is often quite a lot.
So what's your take on a show like Game of Thrones, for example? That's obviously that's fantasy. It's not pretending to be history, but it's got a lot of medieval inspirations. Do you think these kind of shows help people get more interested in the medieval period?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Game of Thrones has been a phenomenal success for lots of reasons. It's done an amazing job, I feel, for getting people to engage with the Middle Ages. And of course, I don't think I've never, ever, ever in my entire life met anyone who said, oh, I watched Game of Thrones. I mean, so what's, you know, tell me, who was this Daenerys Targaryen? You know, where was she really from? No, everyone is cognizant that there's a difference between fantasy set in a sort of historical period and the actual thing. But yeah, it's definitely opened up a sort of a bigger audience of people who would maybe migrate from, hey, I love Thrones, to, hey, you know, I might read a little medieval history as well. I was just joking to say it's a sort of gateway drug into the harder stuff. I sort of still stand by that analogy, in that not everyone is going to graduate from Thrones to
Wars of the Roses.
to reading Jonathan Sumption's sort of, you know, five volumes of The Hundred Years' War. But, I mean, there will be people who take that path, and God bless them and good luck to them.
Have you ever considered writing, maybe not a fantasy novel like Game of Thrones, maybe, but for historical fiction?
Yeah, I've sort of considered it many times and been asked to do it many times, and even sort of started doing it many times, and then become sort of laced with icy sweat at the thought of actually sitting down and writing fiction, because the potential for getting fiction wrong, it seems to me, is massively greater than getting history wrong.
That's so interesting. I'd think it would be the opposite, because I'm like, oh, history, you've got so many facts that could be wrong.
Maybe you're right, and maybe I always come back to finding the idea of writing fiction incredibly exposing, and I just suspect that I would be awful. I mean, I might be wrong, and I reserve the right to do it one day. I always keep thinking, all right, next year I'm going to bite the bullet and become the next Bernard Cornwell or whatever, and then next year I agree to write another history book, and then, you know, there's a bit of me that goes, well, you are doing the sort of thing that you're kind of good at. I mean,
it's a bit of a stick with what you know.
Well, I'm also still, look, I'm 36 years old, nearly 37. And I still, although, you know, I may be eaten by a rhinoceros tonight, I would hope I have a little bit of time left, and that I'm relatively early in my career, and there's time to do these things. And so I don't feel under, well, my point here is that I don't feel under a sort of massive pressure to go and write fiction tomorrow. But like I say, you know, I reserve the right in 6 months' time to say the opposite of this.
Yeah, no, that makes sense though. And it's a completely different kettle of fish.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to write a cookbook.
Historical cookbook?
I don't know. Maybe it would be a different kind of cookbook. I reserve the right. I'll tell you what kind of cookbook. But it's the same sort of thing. If I went to my agent and said, hey, you know what? I don't think history next time. I think cookbook. I mean, I think she'd shoot me, and she'd be right to do so. Or, you know, I want to write a volume of poetry.
We eagerly wait for that.
Right. Doggerel. The reaction in both of those cases would be, really? Are you sure you're not insane? And I think that actually it's not that much of a difference to me saying, well, I think... Now, commercially, that's not the case, obviously, because there's a much greater shared market between history and historical fiction. And like I say, you know, maybe. But, I'm writing a history book at the moment.
Well, why don't we talk about that? What are you writing at the moment?
What I'm writing at the moment is a book called Crusaders. At least that's what it's called at the moment. And having written a book about the Templars, the one from last autumn, that was a kind of... A thread through the Crusades, in a way. One of the reasons I've done the books in this order is because I was like moving into crusading history and wanted a sort of enough focus for writing my first book about it. But the next book takes the same period broadly, but just blows out into a much bigger, more epic kind of book altogether. And so it's covering So it's what I didn't want, what I don't want to write is, yet another version of Runciman, a big, top-down, omniscient kind of survey of the Crusades, partly because there are much cleverer, better historians than me that have done that already. Tom Asprey has done it. Chris Tyerman has done it. Jonathan Phillips has done it. And all three of those have done brilliant. Jonathan Riley Smith, in the late Jonathan Riley Smith. All of those people have written brilliant histories of the Crusades. So I'm trying to do what I feel like I know how to do, which is human story, human narrative. And so it's telling a history of the Crusades through the eyes of a sort of a gallery of characters from across those times. So that's the technique. And if anyone's read my Templars book, and they read the first chapter in which you see Jerusalem in 1102/3 through the eyes of Ceolwulf coming off this ship that gets then destroyed behind him in the sea, and then walking out into this kind of wild west of Jerusalem after the First Crusade, it's kind of that technique writ large.
So who are the big characters in this then?
Well, I don't think I'm going to tell you that because I'm enjoying writing, and I do want to retain a little bit of mystery about this book, but sure. And also because I'm early in the actual writing of it. But what I will say is that it's not just going to be sort of Richard the Lionheart followed by Frederick Hohenstaufen followed by, it's not a white man's crusade, it's not a white Frenchman's crusade. It's about seeing this period through a sort of a multitude of eyes, Western, Latin Christian, Eastern Christian, Islamic, Jewish, Mongol, pagan, when we talk about the Baltic regions, Moorish, all of these people were deeply invested at different points in what we now sort of homogeneously call the Crusades. And I want to reflect the fact that this story is, get away from the fact that this story has so often just been told through the eyes of people from France and Italy and a bit from England, effectively, as though their view really defined what happened. So there's a bit of a sort of fusion of viewpoints in there. I'm also interested on a sort of deeper level about the idea of crusading and partly how it evolved at the time, but more how it's evolved since. Because the word crusade is used an awful lot today, and not just in sort of trite newspaper politics kind of terms, but actually it's a cultural and historical touchstone that's adopted and adapted and owned by lots of different groups, the European far right, the American far right, Mexican drug gang like Los Caballeros Templarios, ISIS, calling Westerners crusaders. There's a lot of groups trying to take ownership of this idea and perpetuate the notion of a religious/civilizational war between Christianity and Islam. Sorry, I've downloaded some slightly incoherent thoughts there, but that's usually how it is when I'm writing. That.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. And you've got a book coming out in August, which is when this podcast is out, called The Colour of Time.
The Colour of Time.
You co-authored with Marina Amaral. Would you like, tell our listeners a bit about this book and the idea behind it?
So about 2 years ago, I was sort of wasting my life on the internet, and I saw people, other historians, tweeting this image of a sort of good-looking young man in his 20s who looked like he was in One Direction or a Calvin Klein model or whatever. Piercing blue eyes, sort of bouffant hair. And this photo had been taken in 1865, and it was a guy called Lewis Powell who'd been involved in the plot to kill Lincoln at the end of the American Civil War. And the disjuncture between, oh, my God, that's an historical photograph, but it's in colour and it looks like something that was taken yesterday for the cover of GQ, just, kind of blew my mind. And I I mean, we've got a copy of the picture on one of the walls over here. I'm still as obsessed with this image as I was when I first saw it. And I kind of traced back through the tweets to where this had come from. And it was a colorized image of an Alexander Gardner photograph. Alexander Gardner was one of the great Civil War photographers. It was a black and white photograph originally. It was a mugshot slash propaganda of Lewis Powell when he was imprisoned on the USS Saugus. It was taken shortly before he was hanged for his part in killing the president. It's an incredibly compelling photograph in black and white, but today most people would look past it in black and white. But colorized, I was like, oh my God, what is this and who's done this? And so I went back and tracked, and it was this, you know, Marine Admiral, who at that time was 21 years old, lives in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, incredibly passionate historian, first and foremost, obsessed with history, but also, by chance, lucky her, an incredible artist. Just this eye and this talent and this ability. So she's taking black and white photographs and using Photoshop and her extensive historical research to colorize them as faithfully as she can, according to what can be known about the colors in that photograph, and then filling in the rest. It's a standard historical process. You learn what you can, you extrapolate what you can't. And anyway, I was like, well, you appear to be some sort of genius. When's your book coming out? No, I don't have a book. I said, right, well, in that case, let's do a book. So we agreed to work together on this book. And like I said, I thought this was going to take about 4 or 5 months. And it's taken 2 years. It's a book of 200 colorized photographs covering the period 1850 to roughly 1960, more or less the first century of photography, when predominantly up until the end point, it was black and white. And these photographs, which I've worked with Marina to select, and I've written a sort of 40,000-word text to accompany them. These photographs tell a story, a world history. It's avowedly a global history. It doesn't just cover America and Western Europe. It's Eastern Europe, it's Asia, it's Africa, it's the world. In an incredibly formative period, it's the Crimean War to the Cold War, it's the Steam Age to the Space Age. I can't remember how many books I've written. I think it's 8, give or take. And this one arriving, you know, my first copy, the first one sort of got off the press, came, and I took the cellophane off the outside, and I haven't been so excited about one of my books arriving, I don't think, ever, because we busted our necks to make this book. And it involved a whole range of different processes that aren't usually part of making a history book. You know, a huge amount of work on the reproducing the photographs so they look good on the page, a massive amount of organisational work in terms of setting the order for the photographs, the selection of the photographs. I mean, I honestly think I looked at 10,000 photographs to select the 200 that are in the book.
How difficult was that select? And what informed your choices? 1,000 reasons, probably.
How difficult was it? It was very difficult. What informed the choices? A range of factors, which is why it was so difficult. Number one, they had to be good photographs. Define good, well, brilliantly composed, taken by great photographers, significant in some historical sense. That doesn't mean they have to be of a famous person, but have some that we can say something that justifies including them in the world history of this period. Technically, they had to be good files. You know, we're working with Getty Images, and Getty have some fantastic, have a vast archive of historical black and white images, but an enormous variation in quality of those images as they've been uploaded. And so I became quite versed in dots per inch, you know, the size in pixels of a particular photograph, knowing whether Marina was going to be able to work on it or not. And often we'd get half or three quarters of the way through her work on a photograph and we'd just have to junk it. Photograph doesn't work. Or you'd find the photographs be mislabeled, or you'd find like a whole range of different reasons why it wouldn't work. And then when one photo dropped out, I'd have set in each chapter, there's 11 chapters in the book, each one between 17 and 23 photographs. I mean, I would have had a very careful running order that made sure there was a range of... Firstly, this was telling the story of the decade in question properly, that there was a range of you know, parts of the world represented, that there were lots of women, there were lots of people who weren't white blokes with big beards, you know. It's the 21st century. I wanted to try and make a 21st century history book. One photo drops out, the balance skews. And then other photos would have to change. And some of those might be photos that worked, or there's older, you know, so this is a big job. And for months and months, you know, first 6 months of this year, when we were right in the weeds with getting this book out, where we're sitting now in my kitchen is a sort of a block, you know, a central block. What do you reckon this is? 9 feet long? Something like that. This was covered, you know, two or three photos deep in photos. The floor, the sofa, my desk, the whole office, the walls were covered in historical photographs. Whittling those down to 200 images and then writing the text, particularly a sort of modern history text, which is something I hadn't necessarily written about since I was in university. Damn, it was quite hard work. And
very different kind of challenge to what you've had before.
But also it was great because it was collaborative. And Marina is God, I can't tell you how good she is to work with. She is like a dream. I've never met anyone with so much like drive, ambition, talent, good humour, like all in one kind of package. It's like, oh my God, you don't think you have any idea how good you are.
And she's only 21,
she's
did
23.
You say?
23. I think she's 23 now. She's a genius.
And they are really remarkable. Like, it's a fantastic way of accessing history and looking at history in a way you've never done before. It's like each page is a window into it. Yeah.
I mean, the idea, what I didn't want to make it was a coffee table book. And I forbade the use of that term. This is a book that is to be read as much as it is to be looked at. Mm-hmm. It is a history book. It's priced as a history book at 25 quid rather than, you know, 40, which a coffee table book would be. It's the same size as Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, you know, in that it will fit on your bookshelf. And I've designed it as well, or Marina and I have designed it, so that, yes, you can open it at any page and there'll be a photograph and a caption of 250 words that will explain that. But you can also read it in sequence. So each caption follows on from the last and leads on to the next. So that if you read this from start to finish, it reads as one text. And that, I don't mind telling you, was hard.
I can imagine, like, tying what? Like, what you're tying together.
Yeah, and you know, you're trying to, like, cover all those. You know, I wanted there to be Japanese history, and Chinese history. And
yeah, how does Japan in 1850 link right through to, you know?
Well, you know, you buy the book, you'll find out.
Out
but,
exactly.
But actually, that process sort of helped the build in that, in putting together a sort of thematic arc through each decade, which helped select the photographs, and then arranging them so they told a story but stayed roughly in chronological sequence. I mean, all of that was like it was like doing a Rubik's Cube a little bit, except doing it the hard way, if you do Rubik's Cube.
I've never solved one, right. So anyways, the hard way.
Let me tell you about Rubik's Cube very briefly. I can teach you to solve Rubik's Cube in 2 hours.
Okay.
It's algorithmic, the solution. Like, and once you know the patterns of moves, you can solve Rubik's Cube literally every single time. There is a way to solve Rubik's Cube that's not algorithmic, and that's by, like, working it out and moving all these different moving parts.
I think that's how I've always tried to do it.
Yeah, that's hard. Now, there was no algorithmic way to solve the problem of A Colour of Time, so I had to do it like doing a Rubik's Cube the hard way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's probably too abstract an analogy, but...
Well, it sounds like a struggle because
weirdly, I did a lot of Rubik's Cube while I was doing it because...
So you could be physically having the same challenge?
Well, no, actually, so that I could physically do the opposite challenge, because it was so frustrating trying to arrange all these different moving parts without others moving in the wrong direction, that to do a Rubik's Cube, which is a purely algorithmic exercise, was actually quite relaxing. It was like, here's a puzzle I can solve in a self-contained 3 minutes. Bit of a boast there, because 3 minutes is quite a good time. however, I can do this, and then I won't feel so bad about the fact that I'm having difficulty solving that bigger problem.
That's so funny. Now I'm picturing my question earlier, as what's your recommendation to a young budding historian? Well, if you're ever puzzling over an anthology of pictures and text, pick up a Rubik's Cube.
Pick a Rubik's Cube. Well, no, but that's quite good advice. I mean, like, funny as it sounds, I do recommend having hobbies or the outside what you do to sort of, because history can get you down and drive you mad. And it also is, even if you don't want distraction, it's also a subject that's quite intensely bound up in problem solving. And if you can have some sort of analogous, like problem solving, I could do a lot of cryptic crosswords as well. I'm quite obsessed with cryptic crosswords. And I'm never going to be in Bletchley Park, right? You know, I'm not Enigma cracking standard. But I do enjoy the process because it's just sort of idle, leisurely problem solving. And I do sort of sense as well that it's a form of useful exercise for your brain.
Mm-hmm. Are you a Sudoku fan?
No.
No?
I mean, I'd sit down and do a Sudoku, but I don't think I'd derive much pleasure from it. Why do you think that is?
I don't know if it's because... Once you know how to do them, they're, you don't actually have to use your brain that much. They're, I don't know, sort of just slots into place. Maybe it's something like that. It's like a jigsaw rather than...
That sounds like a Rubik's Cube. And so maybe I would enjoy it. Now I'm into Ruby. But the cryptic crossword, I find, it tests your vocabulary as well. And it's not just a puzzle, but it's also a... and that's quite useful if you're a writer.
Well, as we're nearing the end of the podcast, I'm going to give you three quick-fire questions to answer.
Is it general knowledge?
No, they're not general knowledge.
Okay.
This is going to be... So just before I came in to interview you, your daughter asked me, are you doing 73 questions with my dad? And I said no, but she's inspired me to do three questions with you.
Well,
they are history related.
Okay, hit me.
So which person from history would you most like to meet and why? You can't think about this too long.
Okay, so off, immediate instinctive knee-jerk answers. Right, Henry V.
Why?
Because he's my favourite Plantagenet king. And I, you know, in the sense that I want to meet one of them, I'd probably, you know, I want to be my favourite Plantagenet. God, I've given him enough of my life in this dynasty. I'd like to catch hold of one.
Which historical period would you like to live in? Probably none of them, but in a literal sense.
I mean, my cutoff point for how far back I'm going to go is penicillin and anaesthesia. So... And really, I don't want to live through the world wars. So I'm actually probably only going back to, like, the 60s.
And seeing as you are a sports writer, have you recovered from England's defeat in the semi-finals last week?
Yeah, this is going to sound unpatriotic, going on treasonous, but I enjoy the World Cup more when England aren't involved because it's just this... very obvious cycle of false hope. And so what happened in this World Cup was quite interesting. The main achievement, as I think we'd all now recognise with the England team, was not just to be despicable people. And actually, the pattern of the football, let's be clear about it, was no different to any other World Cup in that they lost to the first good team they played, Belgium. Then they lost to the second good team they played, which used to be what happened until very recently. What was unusual was they then lost to the third good team they played, but really that was still the first good team because it was Belgium again. So, I mean, has England's football advanced dramatically? No. They got a pretty navigable side of the draw, and it was a weird World Cup in that so many big teams fell out so early. Were they nice people who made this country sort of briefly happy? Yeah, and that's good. But... you know, World Cup's come to an end. And I enjoyed the final yesterday a lot. France
won. Were you glad France won?
Football, well, the World Cup, the Jules Rimet, as we pronounce it in this country, turns out it was coming home, given that Jules Rimet is a Frenchman.
I was personally glad that France won because I had them in the work sweepstake.
Did you?
I was dreading that England and France were going to be up against each other because I was like, well, I've got money riding on France.
Well, yeah, but you shouldn't be dreading that because that's the ultimate hedge, isn't it? You know, you've got emotion on one side and you've got money on the other.
Do I value 20 quid? Would I be happy to lose 20 quid for England to win? And I don't know if I would.
I think that's much more unpatriotic than what I just said.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for coming on the 500th episode of our podcast. We should have done 500 years of history. I should have grilled you on 500 years.
You shouldn't do that, but I'll tell you one more thing. That I've started swimming a lot recently, and I try to do 100 lengths a day, right? And it's very boring. It's very boring to do that. It's repetitive. But that's part of the point, in that it's also meditative. But once you do it every day, you get bored and you lose count as well. So here's a tip for all your readers who are thinking of swimming a large number of lengths every day. I now count down from 100 to 0. This is super nerdy. You're looking at me. Okay, just honestly bear with me.
I'm with you.
So like, say 99. As I'm swimming that length, I try and think of an event that happened in the year that ended with that number. So 99, I'm going to go, okay, 1399, deposition of Richard II. 98, I might go modern, go France 98, last time France won the World Cup. 97, Edward I, the final issue, although not confirmation of Magna Carta, 1297. So you see? And then you go on and on and on like that. And I wouldn't have wanted to sit here and do that with you for 500 years. It would have been monotonous for the reader, for the listeners.
That would have been a pretty boring podcast.
Yeah, it'd be pretty boring. But if this 500th anniversary podcast is about gaining insight into my mind, which weirdly appears to be about, I think there's some insight for you. It's not a pretty view.
That was Dan Jones. And as you'll have heard, he has a new book, The Colour of Time, which has just been published by Apollo. Now, if you'd like to get the chance to meet Dan in the flesh, then you can do so at our History Weekend in Winchester, where he'll be talking about his new book. For more details and tickets, please visit historyweekend.com. And this is the last of this week's special podcasts, but you can, of course, catch up with any you've missed via your usual podcast channels and at historyextra.com. And the website is also the place to listen to many more of our past 500 episodes, some of which are only available to BBC History Magazine subscribers via our online library. And meanwhile, we'll be back on Monday with more from the world of history.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com. And we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.